you have dialed has not been recognized. Please check and try again.
This is your host Ponyboy, and you're listening to episode number 32 of Belcore Radio. Now, I am joined by a very special guest here tonight. Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Ilonka Dutton, speaking from St. Charles, Missouri.
Now, Ilonka is a pretty famous person, which I can tell is, you know, it's a big change for everybody who listens to Belcore Radio. She's been published in what? I mean, like, basically every major news outlet I can really think of. I'm not going to list it because it'll probably take a while, but I mean, you know.
It feels like that sometimes, especially because yesterday I was on, I'm like a total fangirl of NPR, and I was on NPR yesterday. As we're recording this, it's Saturday, so I was on NPR on Friday, and then being in the New York Times today, and I've Wired News, I've got like some of the Wired reporters on IM, so I kind of like send them news tips, and they ask me if I've heard about different stories, so yeah.
And so why exactly is it that you've been so busy these past few days?
Oh, well, you've been to my talk at Nauticon.
Yes.
Where I talk about cryptography, and for those of your listeners who aren't familiar with my particular area of expertise here, I kind of have a specialty in some of the world's most famous unsolved codes, and I've also cracked a bunch of codes in the hacker scene, like the Freaknik code and the Atlanticon 2 code. And one of the codes I know about one of the world's most famous unsolved codes is a sculpture at the center of CIA headquarters, which is called Kryptos. And it was installed in 1990, and it was installed as a challenge to the employees at the agency. And there are four codes on it, four parts to it. We have solved three of the parts. I mean, when I say we, I mean cryptographers and cryptanalysts around the world. But the first three parts are solved. The fourth part has not been solved yet, and so it's one of the world's most famous unsolved codes. And I got a phone call from the artist, the sculptor, Jim Sanborn, on Wednesday of this week, you know, so 4 days ago, recently said, oh, you know that part two of the sculpture that everybody thinks they've cracked? Well, I left something out on the sculpture and everybody has it wrong. So I did some back and forth with him and back and forth with other members of our group, and we figured out what part two was supposed to say after we repaired it, and then told the world about that, and just all kinds of press has been going on since then. Wired, New York Times, NPR, BBC Radio, Slashdot, of course, I'm on Dig, and now, finally, I'm on Pony Boy's show.
Exactly. That's when you know you have reached the pinnacle of media coverage.
My personal goal, as I told you and IMs, I haven't made it big until I've been on your show.
Exactly. I mean, that's how it is. We get all the famous people on here.
There you go.
But now, so, why, I mean, like, he just, was it that he just made a typo when he was putting it together, or?
Well, that's a really good question, because, and my group, we have a Yahoo group with several hundred people who are discussing this furiously right now, just all kinds of back and forth, like, was it a deliberate mistake? Did he just mess up, or did he do something deliberately and then he just forgot because it's been 16 years? How much was he involved with it? He worked with a cryptographer named Ed Scheit, who was the head of the CIA's cryptographic center, and maybe Ed taught him something and Jim Sanborn did something, but then he sort of forgot, and maybe Ed remembers. So we don't know for sure whether it was a mistake or whether it was deliberate or what it was. I did get a tip from someone who I know is a crypto expert, and they contacted me, and this hasn't appeared in any media yet, so you're breaking the story on this, but they contacted me and said, look into the concept of duress ciphers, D-U-R-E-S-S. And I'm like, well, what do you mean by that? And he said, well, just give it some thought. Thanks a lot. So a duress cipher, which I wasn't really familiar with, but I've been doing some research on it, is a way of sending a message when you're under duress. For example, if someone has been captured and they are being forced to give a statement, and they want to get across to the folks back home that they are being forced to give the statement, but they're not allowed to say, hey, I'm being forced to give the statement, because then they're dead. So they will work something in there. I think, like, on some episodes of Star Trek, they had something similar, like, you know, Kirk would flip open his communicator, and he'd be ready to be beamed up, and he'd say, code green. And, you know, up on the Enterprise, they go, ah, code green means that it's really not okay, that there's something wrong. But so I don't know what the tip means. It may mean that it's a signal for something else, or it may just mean that they incorporated this kind of a thing on the sculpture because Kryptos was meant to represent several different types of classical cryptography, and they saw a duress cipher as one type of thing that needed to be represented.
Well, now, what always really, like, in the time that I spent after I saw your presentation at Nauticon, and I kind of read back through your website and kind of through the course of events that went on since you started, you know, studying the sculpture and everything, do you ever think that it might just be that Jim Sanborn is just kind of messing with your guys' heads?
All the time.
I don't know. And I mean, I heard, you know, your response to this on the NPR podcast I listened to, but it just seems kind of strange that just, you know, all of a sudden he goes, oh, by the way, you know that thing that everyone's been talking about for 8 years? Well, you know, I know that's not what it is, but...
Well, as for why he came up with it, I think it has to do with all the increased media attention lately on cryptos, and part of it relates to this book, The Da Vinci Code, by Dan Brown, which is currently one of the biggest selling books in the world right now. And also, so your listeners are aware, in the U.S. hardcover edition of The Da Vinci Code, in the book jacket and the dust cover, hidden within the artwork of the dust cover, there are five puzzles. And again, the book was printed in 2003, and two of those hidden puzzles refer to cryptos. There's the latitude and longitude coordinates that come from part two of the sculpture that are hidden in very faint light red on dark red on the back cover, and also very faintly on the back cover it says only WW knows, which is a reference again to part two of cryptos. And So Kryptos has just been getting hugely famous. I've just been getting tens of thousands of visitors to my website researching, you know, why is Kryptos mentioned on Da Vinci Code. And some people say, oh, does Dan Brown know the answer to K4? And no, I don't think he knows the answer. But he's Brown, the author of Da Vinci Code, is obviously fascinated by codes and ciphers. And he has, in other of his books as well, he hides secret messages which give hints about the subject of his next novel. So in one of his books, Deception Point, he put a code at the end of it where if you decipher the code, it says, the Da Vinci Code will surface. And so now in Da Vinci Code, we've got these five hints. And we know that the next book after Da Vinci Code is going to be called The Solomon Key. It's going to take place in Washington, D.C., and it's going to be about the secret society of the Freemasons. And Brown's books are generally treasure hunts. It's like, go here, get a clue, go here, get a clue, go here, get a clue. So my guess is that Kryptos, and this is just a guess, but my guess is that the CIA Kryptos sculpture is going to be one of the stops in Brown's next book. You know, go to Kryptos, get some clue, and then go on to the next thing at the convention center or whatever. So because of all this attention on Kryptos, people are writing books about it. And I've got a book. I was approached by a British book publisher last year. So I have a book that was just released a couple weeks ago called The Mammoth Book of Secret Codes and Cryptograms. And I sent, I've been sending free copies of that. And you saw at Nauticon that I gave out a couple books as prizes. And I sent a copy to Jim Sanborn, the Kryptos sculptor. And he had just gotten my copy. Just gotten the copy that I sent him, and then he's on the phone to me. So it's possible that he was kind of looking through and to seeing what I had about Kryptos in my book, and he may have seen the plain text and went, ooh, this error, I didn't realize that this was as big an error as it was. I mean, how much the public is just certain that this is wrong, or certain that they have the ID by Rose, but it's wrong, and I really need to set the record straight because this is starting to appear in books which have a wider reach. And Sanborn is also going to be working on his own book as well, so he has to get all the ducks lined up on that and make sure he's got copyright stuff figured out and just all the other things that happen when you're publishing a book. You want to make sure that it's accurate, and if there's a problem, he needs to set the record straight before the book comes out.
And now, I don't think that we kind of clarified this before, but I heard you mentioned what was previously thought to say at the end, ID by Rose or ID by Row S, but what does it really say now that's been figured out now at least?
Okay, so I'll read to you what we know about the deciphered part of the sculpture.
Excellent.
Okay, so there's the three parts. The first part is one sentence. It comes out saying, between subtle shading and the absence of light lies the nuance of occlusion. And the second part says, well, what we thought it said was, it was totally invisible. How is that possible? They used the Earth's magnetic field, X. The information was gathered and transmitted underground to an unknown location, X. Does Langley know about this? They should. It's buried out there somewhere, X. Who knows the exact location? Only WW. This was his last message, X. 38 degrees, 57 minutes, 6.5 seconds north, 77 degrees, 8 minutes, 44 seconds west, ID by Rose. And now, so with the new information that came in this week, that last part has changed. So I won't read the whole thing again, but instead of saying 77 degrees, 8 minutes, 44 seconds west, ID by Rose, what it really says is, what Sanborn said it's supposed to say is, 77 degrees, 8 minutes, 44 seconds west, X, layer 2. And then part 3 says, slowly, desperately slowly, the remains of passage debris that encumbered the lower part of the doorway was removed. With trembling hands, I made a tiny breach in the upper left-hand corner, and then, widening the hole a little, I inserted the candle and peered in. The hot air escaping from the chamber caused the flame to flicker, but presently details of the room within emerged from the mist. X. Can you see anything? Q. And we know that part, that last part is an extract from the diary of an archaeologist, November 26, 1922, from the diary of Howard Carter on the day that he discovered King Tut's tomb. The the part one and part two, those are seem to be original sentences that were written by Sanborn. And he said that the first one, the between subtle shading and the absence of light lies the nuance of occlusion. He said it's an original sentence written by him with carefully chosen wording. And we don't know what he means by that, but I'd say it's a pretty good chance that there's something, some other layer involved with part one that we just haven't figured out yet either.
Yeah, it sounds like it's like a fairly complicated, I can't think of the word.
Well, it's hard.
Yeah, it's very well put together. It was calculated is the
it
word I'm
crafted,
looking for.
Crafted, yes. And Ed Scheidt to New York Times, I actually got to listen to part of the interview when he was talking to New York Times, and Ed Scheidt, who had taught Sanborn about encryption, he too said that the puzzle was built with many, many different layers. Many different layers. And he said another interesting thing. He said about the first three parts that we had solved them, but we had access to the English, meaning that he said that the patterns of the language were exposed, which meant that we could do things like frequency analysis and other things that code crackers use. But he says for part four, he said that the English has been obscured. And the answer is still English. It's not in a weird language. And it uses a classical cryptography system, but he says that the patterns of the language have been obscured, and we do not know what that means. It drives us insane.
Maybe it's just in Pig Latin.
It's possible. Pig Latin is a perfectly valid encryption system. It's not particularly secure for sending large amounts of text, because as soon as the enemy figures it out, they're going to crack messages very rapidly. But if you just need to send something really quick and it's got a very short half-life on it, meaning that your recipient is going to receive the message, they're going to deal with it, and then you don't need to worry if the message gets into enemy hands after that, then Pig Latin is perfectly fine. The perfect code is generally something that has been used in wartime conditions. That was the primary use of codes. And so a good code needed to be something that could be used easily, meaning someone could easily encrypt it and also could easily decrypt it, and usually under battlefield conditions, you know, things are blowing up around you and you don't have a lot of time to run a lot of spreadsheets. So it needs to be something that can be quickly encrypted, quickly decrypted, but is relatively secure as it's passing from sender to receiver.
Well, actually, this is something that I've been curious about, because since I saw your presentation at Nauticon, I've been getting very interested in codes and ciphers myself. And
glad to hear it.
And, you know, I mean, I found a fairly decent book that I can't quite remember who wrote it, but it's called Codes and Ciphers something. I'm not
secret
sure.
Secret Writing? Codes, Ciphers, and Secret Writing?
No, I don't think so.
By Martin Gardner?
I think it's the last name is Rixton.
Okay.
I'm not sure, but I'm curious. Like, what? I mean, I'm sure that you've probably read several books at least on this kind of subject. What would you recommend to people who are just kind of, you know, just kind of learning about all this stuff?
The number one book that I recommend is by Simon Singh, Singh, and he wrote a book called The Code Book a few years ago, which is a really excellent introduction to cryptography. It's not perfect. There are some mistakes in the book, and there's places where he kind of took artistic license in describing some things. But it's a very it's an entertaining read, and it gives just an excellent overview on several different historical systems. Another one is like I mentioned, the Martin Gardner book, which is Codes, Ciphers, and Secret Writing, I think is the title. And I definitely recommend that one. Now, if someone wants to dig into deeper stuff, the quintessential book on it, on the subject, is called The Code Breakers by David Kahn, K-A-H-N. And he wrote it a couple decades ago, and I went to an NSA, National Security Agency, conference last year, and there are still people saying that's the book to get. It has so much respect within the government circles. Now, and also for overviews, I have to mention my book, Mammoth Book of Secret Codes and Cryptograms, which overall, it's the main purpose of the book is to give people puzzles to solve. There are several hundred puzzles in there. About half of them are really simple things, the kind that you'd see in a newspaper. Pretty much anybody, your grandmother could solve these. But then I've also got codes, and they get progressively harder and progressively harder, and I also have instructions in the book so that I wrote the book under what I call a desert island rule, meaning if you're on a desert island or on a plane, it's never going to say, oh, get the following book and you'll get the chart here, and you don't have it with you on the plane. I mean, it always makes me crazy. So I wrote my book with desert island, meaning everything you need to solve the codes in the book is in the book. All the charts are in there, all the explanations are there, all the tutorials are there. And so the book explains different cryptographic systems, and it goes as far as someone really wants to go with pencil and paper systems. I have some codes in there that use actual wartime ciphers that were used, like, by Julius Caesar's army. And I have systems that, like President John F. Kennedy, before he was president, at one point he needed to send messages from when he was in trouble in the South Pacific. And he used a system called Playfair, so I've got Playfair ciphers in there. And I've even got a chapter that was submitted by Scott Kim, who's a really famous puzzle designer, and he has a pencil and paper way of understanding asymmetric key cryptography, including all the prime number stuff. And so a lot of the geeks that I've been telling about are very interested in that section as well. And then if someone can get through all those, of course I've got half a dozen of the world's most famous unsolved codes, like the Beale ciphers and the Voynich manuscript and Cryptos. And also, for your listeners, I have a treasure hunt. I have a made-up puzzle hidden. So a puzzle hidden within the puzzles of the book. And there will be prizes, small prizes, for the first solvers, like a personalized gift for each one. So far, no one's done it. And I could probably toss out a clue to your listeners saying if they get their hands on a copy of the book, check page 16 of that.
And so the book is out now? Like, I could go to the store and get it now?
Or? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was released in the United States on March 28th of this year. And I have talked to some bookstore managers like Borders and Barnes & Noble, and they tell me that their corporate book buyers, they kind of look into their crystal ball and see, how many people are going to buy this book? Do we want to have it on shelves? Is it going to be special order? And what they do is they go, this movie, The Da Vinci Code, is coming out in May. Okay. Normally the buyers will say, don't get a copy, let's see how it does, or they'll say, get one copy. But as I understand it, the buyers are going, okay, Da Vinci Code's coming out, let's get two copies in every bookstore in America, and we'll see how it does after that. And from what I hear, it's been selling pretty well. So yeah, any Borders should have it, any Barnes & Noble, or of course you can get on Amazon.com. I've heard that Walmart.com is shipping faster than Amazon.com, but it's just like a one-day difference. Now, the book will be released in England next week on April 27th.
And now, offhand, do you happen to know the publisher's price that they're charging for it initially?
I'm going from memory here, but I think in the United States it's $13.95.
Excellent.
Cover price, but you can get it on Amazon for like $9 or $10. And in England, I think it's £8, but I'm sure they're going to have a discount there as well.
Excellent. So it's a very, very reasonable price, too, then, for, you know.
I've also discovered kind of an interesting scam that seems to be going on Amazon, which is when my book first went live on Amazon.com, within 24 hours, used copies, it says click here to buy used copies. Within 24 hours, there was like 15 used copies, and I'm like, okay, hang on. My ego aside here, there is no way that many people have bought books and already have used copies to sell. What's going on here? And it was also frustrating to me because at that time, in many stores across the country, the books had not even arrived on shelves yet. So I'm like, how is it that the book just went live on Amazon, there's already used copies? And I'm not certain of this, but what the general thinking seems to be is that as soon as a book goes live on Amazon, there are a bunch of resellers who are immediately buying the book, and then they offer it used. Now, supposedly, they're offering it used at a lower price. They say, well, Amazon's selling it for $10. Well, we'll sell it to you for $9. But in reality, they're putting a big shipping and handling fee on it. So I think they're buying it themselves from Amazon and then reselling it and trying to get like an extra buck along the way because of the shipping and handling fee. So they're kind of skimming a buck off of every book that they can sell. So the general lesson is, if you go to Amazon and it says, here's the Amazon price, but oh, the used price is just $1 less, I'll go used, don't, because you're probably going to end up spending more.
Yeah. I don't know, that seems kind of a little shady.
It does. It does. Some of these people are evidently taking advantage of the Amazon free shipping. So, and I think Amazon is starting to put up announcements saying that if you're using free shipping, this is not a deal for resellers. But you know, just saying that the policy is not going to make anybody do anything. They're just going to go ahead and do whatever they want to do.
Yeah,
so I imagine Amazon is probably going to take steps. It's like the arms race with the black hats. Amazon is probably going to have to do things like checking, are these people repeatedly buying all the new books? You know, they seem to be buying a lot of new books, and they may even set up some stings, I don't know.
Well, I mean, it'll probably end up being just a sense of Amazon will start cracking down on it, so they'll just switch over to, and just start selling them immediately on eBay or something for...
Yeah, I'm sure it happens on eBay as well. In fact, my guess is that some of the eBayers are probably doing this on Amazon.
Yeah, I'm sure it happened on eBay before Amazon started including their used book sections. So,
yeah.
Well, let's see. What else can I ask you while I got you on the line here? Now you don't, for a living, this isn't what you do for a living, correct?
Correct. My day job is that I make computer games. I'm in Sagetronics Corporation, Play.net, and we do some of the massively multiplayer online role-playing games on the net. And we've got text games, and we've got 3D graphical games. We won the first ever award for Online Game of the Year from Computer Gaming World Magazine. And we're working on a big new graphical game called Hero's Journey, which we're getting ready to show at E3 next month.
Excellent. And so... I mean, how did you get into this whole thing? All the cryptography and everything, from just working at it, going from working on computer games into this.
Well, I've always been interested in puzzles, and my friends will tell you from when I was a kid that I was just I'd be perched over a jigsaw puzzle all the time. My mother talks about even before I could read, she'd kind of like just put me on a doorstep with a puzzle, and I would just be happy for hours. And there was a neighborhood boy who was, I think he was studying for a Boy Scout merit badge or something, but he had books on codes at his house, and I was just all over at his house asking questions. And finally he just gave me all of his books on codes and stuff. But it was always just as a hobby until 2000, when I was speaking on games at a big convention in Atlanta at Dragon Con. I'm sure you're familiar with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was giving a talk there, and through the track I was speaking at, the Electronic Frontiers track, I was meeting other speakers in the same track. And as you know, Southeast 2600 is there a lot. And so because we were all speakers in the same track, that's how I kind of got to know them. We'd, you know, wave in the halls and have a beer at the end of the day. And through them, I heard about this code called the Freaknik 3 code, which had been released at the Freaknik 3 convention in 1999 as a challenge to the attendees, and it hadn't been cracked yet. It had been a year, and no one had cracked the code. But they were still handing out flyers, and now they were using the code, saying the Freaknik 3 code, to promote the Freaknik 4 convention, saying crack this code and win a free trip to Freaknik 4. And so after DragonCon, I was I'm picking up all the flyers. You always pick up a big handful of these at conventions, and when I went home and I was kind of sorting through the flyers, I think I was homesick with the flu one weekend or something. I was just bored. And so I started playing with the code, and then I just got totally obsessed. I was in that zone where no one could talk to me unless they wanted to talk to me about the code. I had friends IMing me, and I'd be like, don't talk to me unless you want to talk about the code. but it worked because I got totally into this code, and I did a ton of research, and I learned a lot of stuff, and I cracked the code. And I won the free trip to Freaknik 4, free hotel, drinks, T-shirts, all that. And then I started cracking a bunch of other codes in the hacker scene. And I actually cracked so many that I was banned from competition. Like at the AtlantaCon 2, convention, when they released their code on the sheet of paper, at the bottom of the paper, it said, "Note, past puzzle crackers are ineligible for prizes associated with solving the Atlanticon 2 code. Give someone else a chance, Ilanka." And so, of course, I cracked that one, too. And then the guy who wrote the code was, like, leaving rude messages about me on the white on the light board at the convention. But, ha-ha, I cracked his code. And then I started getting involved with some other crypto things. Like, after September 11th, I was wondering if I could use my crypto skills to help out with the war on terrorism. And so I was invited to local FBI meetings to give talks about steganography and the rumors that Al-Qaeda might have been using steganography as a way of planning the September 11th attack. I don't believe that they were, but I put together this talk about what steganography was and what was and was not known about Al-Qaeda codes. And then that talk got me invited out to CIA headquarters. And I while they're at CIA headquarters, I'm there, you know, having lunch, and I'm looking up at this big crypto sculpture and going, And I did some rubbings of the sculpture and brought them home, and they made a real mess in my suitcase. And then I posted the rubbings online, and I just had this little one web page with the rubbings and a little bit of information saying, well, there's like three or four links to other cryptos information. And then just people started writing me and saying, oh, you must know about cryptos. Can you tell me this? Can you tell me that? And I'm like, I don't know, but I'll go see if I can find the answer. And I go find the answer and tell them, and then other people would write to me and say, well, do you know that? And do you know this? And I'm like, I don't know. And so I go get that information. And gradually building this FAQ, frequently asked questions list on my website, and just more and more people writing. And then I'd get people writing me saying, oh, I've solved part four. And I'm like, great, tell me what the answer is. And they say, well, if you take this letter and this letter and this letter, it's my home address. It's proof that the aliens are watching. I'm like, okay, thanks very much. And just going on and just getting more and more correspondence. And then I was writing back and forth with this guy named Gary Warzen, one of the real cryptos researchers in Indiana. And while talking to him, I came up with a new way of solving part three. And then he said, well, you know, what do you think about starting a discussion group? And I said, well, that's a great idea. And so he started it, and then I started inviting people into it, and it grew and grew, and now it's got over, like, 850 people in it. And it's just been this amazing ride. It just keeps growing and growing and growing.
Well, you mentioned the person who has aliens watching them.
I get several of those. I get about one a week.
A lot of the crazies coming into you?
Yeah, especially with all this media attention now. I've definitely been getting a few over that. And the really entertaining ones I put in a folder, and maybe they'll go into a book someday.
that's actually what I was getting at. Have you ever thought about putting up a little subpage on your website or something of crazy people who write me emails? Or
I've thought about it, but I also know that if I do that, it's just going to encourage them.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to get people who are, like, totally sane sending me crazy stuff just so they can see if they can get up on the crazy page. So I have and also just, like, you know, in my copious free time, if I have more time right now, there's definitely things I'd want to update. Like, I have a whole website about the artist James Sanborn with a list of, like, every piece he's ever done. And since I've been talking to him on the phone now, I know about other pieces he's done, which may or may not have a bearing on cryptos. But I have pictures of them. I know what year they were made. And I need to get that database updated, but it's this huge, tedious process. And I just haven't had the time to do that. Plus, of course, I have a day job, you know, making games, and my public speaking schedule has been increasing, and trying to promote my book and setting up book signings, and it's been quite a ride lately.
Well, I mean, I can't say that I can relate to it, but I mean, I can only imagine, you know, what with being, you know, there's so few people really who are at least well known to be studying this sculpture and the code and whatnot. And I can only imagine how much, what am I trying to say? How much, you know, email, how many people you have trying to contact you that, you know, you don't want to be just like, okay, well, you know, you're asking me the questions everybody asks me, so I'm not going to answer you. But I can just imagine that it's, you know, it must get hectic.
It does, and I also have to give props to some people in my group, though, because often the attention comes to me because I'm like one of the more visible members.
Yeah.
As one of the co-moderators. However, there are definitely a lot of hardworking people in my group who don't get as much public attention. For example, with this whole layer two thing, the word layer two, I should go through the story here, which is that when Sanborn called me and he said, okay, something's wrong with part two, and I said, okay, thanks, and then I am with one of the other main co-moderator, which is Chris Hansen. And I'm saying, oh, and Sanborn said this, and Sanborn said that. And Chris is like, oh, well, what do you think? What about this? And I wonder if it means that we need to shift this or do that. And then I was playing with another utility that was written by a guy named Tyler. He has a website at rumpkin.com. He has this really awesome utility for manipulating the code on cryptos. And it makes it very easy to quickly experiment with different methods. And so I went and basically the first thing I tried, and boom, all of a sudden I had a different answer at the end of part two. And when I saw the words change from ID by rows to layer two, I've seen layer two before, and I knew that last year, actually, in October of last year, one of the members of my group, Monet Friedrich, was playing with different methods of manipulating the text on cryptos. And what Monet was doing was trying different keys. The key to part two is the word abscissa, which is spelled A-B-S-C-I-S-S-A-A. And what Monet was doing was shifting the letters in the word. So, like, instead of using abscissa, take the A from the beginning and put it at the end. So you have the word spelled B-S-C-I-S-S-A-A. And say, well, what happens if you try this? And then move the B to the end, and then move the S to the end, move the C to the end, and see how that changes the text. And what Monet noticed is that in one of these manipulations, Monet got at the end of part two the words player two. And Monet sent this to Liz saying, hey, I found the words player two at the end of part two. And we were all like, wow, that's kind of interesting. And some other members of my group, like Paul Kiesel, Mark Siegel, Thorne Kontos, they looked at it and said, well, you know, player two, but what if you take the P off and you have the layer two, well, that lines up exactly with the ID by rows part, so I wonder if that means anything. But we get these kinds of discoveries all the time where we get like maybe a word here, a word here, and we can't really tell, is it coincidence or does it really mean something? But we all agreed that it was a really interesting discovery, and it might be coincidence or maybe not, but Monet definitely gets credit for finding that. And so when I was talking with Chris Hansen this week, and I did my manipulation, I got that layer two pop up. I'm like, aha, I've seen that before. And so now our group's charter is that anything that anyone who joins the group agrees that any discoveries that are made by the group are announced as a group. And part of that is to encourage this back and forth free sharing of ideas, so we don't have people that are like sitting in a cave saying, well, I found this about cryptos, but I'm not going to tell anyone because then, you know, I'm not going to get any credit for it. And so we all agreed, when I wrote the press release, and then I sent the press release to everyone in the group to review, and I was very careful to not include anyone's name on the press release. I said, members of the Cryptos group. But we also do maintain a timeline where we say, well, the first person who discovered this was this person, and then there was an independent discovery by this person. And so I have to give props to Monet Friedrich, because October 11, 2005, I think it was, Monet Friedrich was the first person to get the words layer two out of cryptos. So I've mentioned this to some of the other reporters, you know, New York Times, NPR, and I'm saying, well, you know, Monet Friedrich did this, but then when the actual article comes out or the NPR segment, they always edit these things down. And it's another something that I find very frustrating, especially when, like, the New York Times reporter was interviewing Ed Scheidt. And I was on the phone call because I put together the conference call with Ed and the reporter. And Ed is, you know, saying all these real interesting observations about cryptos. And then when the actual New York Times article comes out, they use, like, one quote. And I'm like, no, you need to, like, post a word-for-word transcript of everything that Ed said. So I'm taking notes by Matt, like Matt, and so I'm trying to share that information with the group. And I say, well, you know, Ed said this and Ed said that. And that way, at least the information is gotten out to the group that way. So one of my goals for being on your show today, actually, was to make sure that Monet got props and proper respects, proper credits for what Monet did. Good job, Monet.
Oh, well, I'm going to edit all this anyways.
Touché. I'll call Monet back. I'm sorry, I tried.
And, of course, and then this thing was discovered by Ilonka, and...
Of course, he'll put in some other name. And then the discovery was made by Pony Boy.
Yeah. So let's see. What else can we ask? Well, I don't know. I'm kind of at a loss now.
I'm trying to think if your listeners will have any particular questions on it. I think it's just some general other information about crypto. It was commissioned for the new headquarters building in 1988, and then it was installed in 1990. The artist Sanborn had never done an encrypted sculpture before. He'd done large public art projects, but never something with a code or even any kind of real text on it. But after he got the commission to do the sculpture for CIA, then he started researching the CIA a lot, and he decided he wanted to do something with a secret message, so he was teamed with Ed Scheidt. And Ed, in the New York Times article today, actually admitted for the first time that he knows the answer. He's never admitted that before. So that was I'm glad that the New York Times got that into their article. But it always cracks me up. New York Times, instead of saying, well, Ilonka Dunham said this and Ed Scheidt said that, it's always Mr. Scheidt said and Ms. Dunham said. It just sounds so formal because I'm just like, you know, sitting there barefoot while I'm talking to the New York Times, and then it shows up, and it's like I showed up at a seat at their office or something.
So maybe it is a good thing, though, that he finally admitted that he does know the answer, because maybe that'll... Maybe he'll start getting some of these emails instead of you.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure he already gets them. I'm sure he gets them. I'm sure that Sanborn gets them. And I'm sure that other people get them. I have people, like, every time a reporter does a story, the reporter generally starts getting some emails from crazies, too, saying, oh, well, I saw this, and it's proof that Angkor Wat was built by Martians or something. And then the reporter will come to me and sometimes they can tell it's from a crazy, but sometimes they'll come to me and say, well, this person says that they solved it. And I'm like, okay, well, did they say what the answer was? And the reporter will say, no, but they said that they solved it.
Yeah. I solved it 20 years ago.
Yeah, it's something that I find frustrating, especially when somebody goes out on the web and they put up a web page saying, I solved Cryptos Part 4, but I'm not going to tell you what it says. Yeah. And then people get all excited thinking that it's been solved, but it hasn't. Yeah, it's just somebody saying that. Or somebody says, well, I solved it first. You know, I solved it before the CIA did, and I told them, and they just didn't want to say so because it's all a government conspiracy. I'm like, and then I go to one of these guys' web pages, and he says, I solved Cryptos first, and he's got a big picture of Cryptos with the Mona Lisa overload on it. And I'm like, okay, guess which book you're trying to capitalize on, right?
Yeah.
he's trying to ride the whole Da Vinci Code fame. So it's sad that people do that.
Yeah, I'm kind of confused as to how just overlaying the Mona Lisa on Cryptos solves it, personally. But
I was saying, Cryptos is famous because of Da Vinci Code, and there's a picture of Mona Lisa on Da Vinci Code. So if I put Mona Lisa next to Cryptos, that means I solved Cryptos.
Oh, I understand it now. I think I just solved Cryptos. Well, I think that is probably about all there is for me to ask you, unless there's...
Any of your listeners who want more information, my website is Ilonka.com, Ilonka.com. I've got more information on Cryptos. I've got a good list of recommended reading if they want other... books on cryptography. I've got a big long list, and I have links to like the world's most famous unsolved codes, and more information on my book if anyone wants to go in and get more info there. And my email address, I'm easily reached at ilonka@gmail.com.
And just to kind of, we kind of at the end of every show, we like to try and, you know, if you have anybody you would like to you know, give shouts to if you want to say hi to mom or whatever, because I'm sure she listens.
Religiously, man. She was just telling me at dinner the other day, man, that pony boy is cool.
What can I say? The ladies love me.
Well, like I said, shout outs definitely to Monet and the other people in the Cryptos group, you know, Paul and Thorne and Mark and everyone that I'm, you know, Chris Hansen, and, you know, Jim Sanborn and Ed Scheidt, and thank you to the CIA for having the sculpture and all that good stuff. Everyone who did work on the sculpture that has, allowed us or in some way pressured the sculptor to come up with this announcement this week, thank you very much. I do appreciate it.
Well, awesome. And I would like to thank you for coming on the show.
Well, my pleasure.
And I want to give shouts to Jim Sanborn as well for giving a lot of people stuff to do for, you know, hours on end. Something to do with all of their free time. But, so I guess that's going to wrap it up for the episode. This has been Ponyboy, and you're listening to NPR. No. as I urge you guys every week, keep hacking, keep freaking, and keep having fun. This has been Ponyboy, and
this is Ilanka.
And this is the end of file.